the just war did not originate with Christian. It's been most heavily influenced by Christians since Augustine in the 4th century and Aquinas in the 12th century. Aquinas added the concept of proportionality, the fourth there in the series, and you can read what that has to do, how that applies. The other term, discrimination, has to do with it's an enlargement of some of these other concepts, and has to do with the idea that in a just war there is some distinction made between combatants and non-combatants. It has to do with the kind of weaponry you use and whether or not that weaponry is sufficiently controllable so as to discriminate between victims who happen to be combatants or non-combatants. So that's a very brief introduction to those two terms. We just wanted to give you a leg up before they came along and you said what. The sources there are both quite good. The Bainton book is a complete historical survey and very readable. It is in our library here. The first by Father Fahey is a pamphlet which you could look over tomorrow if you wanted to come to the 4 o'clock session on peacemaking resources. It's available at that address by the Christopher Fathers, and it's quite a good summary of Bainton's study. So with that, Marilyn will introduce the text a little bit.
The author of the morality play for a nuclear age, which we're going to be dramatically reading tonight, is a man by the name of James Stigenga, and he is a professor of political science at Purdue University. He has carefully done his homework, and so you can know that the information concerning the types of weapons that are discussed in the play, the types of military maneuvers which are spoken of as having taken place in Europe, in the setting of the play. He has based all of this upon actual weapons now in existence, possessed by both the Soviet Union and the United States. So he has done a lot of research and has used military sources as well as peace resources in doing his research before writing this play. So you can imagine that this is a plausible situation.
There are three characters in the play. I will be reading the part of General Frank Dunbar, a sort of gruff NATO commander in his 50s. Marilyn will read the part of his wife, Margaret Brougham Dunbar, daughter of a prominent British scientist and in her own right an important essayist and professor of classics at Amherst College. And Marty Wells will be reading the part of Charles V. Pierce, a lawyer friend of the Dunbars. The setting is the Dunbar living room. And it begins with Frank and Margaret listening to the evening radio broadcast.
And so on this, the 17th day of war in Europe, the Soviet Union's forces are continuing increasingly effective opposition from NATO's defenders, especially in the center of the 1,000-mile-long front. Here in Amherst, meanwhile, General Frank Dunbar remains secluded under virtual house arrest after being flown back from Europe on Wednesday. General Dunbar was commander of NATO's northern sector until he was relieved by President Van de Veen after reportedly refusing to obey a direct presidential order to use tactical nuclear weapons in the European war. Finally, the Wall Street plunge seems to have bottomed out with analysts predicting.
Any good news from over there?
Not much at all. Getting the hell kicked out of us for the most part. Though there are some bright spots. Eddie Hobbs, you remember him? He's doing okay in Austria. The Air Force boys are proving that our pilots and our gadgets are even better than we'd ever hoped they'd be. And the British, they may not be rulers of the sea, but they're doing a damn good job of chasing subs away from our convoys. But overall, We sure as hell haven't started winning.
And you? How are you today? Still feeling a bit punk?
Better. I'm a survivor, you know that. Just going to be a tad grumpy for the next few days, okay? You forgive me?
Of course. Frank, will they court-martial you?
Oh, I doubt it. When this madness is over one way or the other, they will all have better things to do than hassle an old has-been soldier.
Then why is Charlie Pierce sneaking up here today? He called while you were out jogging. Said to look for him a little after noon. Said he'd park a few blocks away and walk in through the ravine. All very mysterious for old, fat, stodgy, rich folks lawyer Charlie Pierce, no?
I wanted him to avoid the vultures of the Fourth Estate camped out front. I wanted some advice and counsel before I have to go out front and talk to them, to congressmen, and maybe even to His Excellency Folksy Bob Vanderveen, if he should summon me. And Charlie may be fat, but old? Remember, he was my classmate at the Point. Anyway, he's damn smart. He left the Army, didn't he? Before he got too old to do anything else? He's out there in the real world making the kind of loot that a guy with a British princess for a wife ought to be making, huh?
Well, that's probably Charlie now. I'll let him in, but then I've got to sneak out myself to quarrel a bit with the dean. Life must go on and all that.
Charlie?
Good to see you.
Good to see you, Charlie. Say, you're going to have to stay for a few days and take up jogging. I've had too many four-martini lunches, but I should talk. How the hell are you anyway?
Oh, about as good as could be expected. Living under the shadow of the mushroom cloud, watching the bottom fall out of the market, proposing my hopes for mankind's survival, and for Pete's sake, old Bob Vanderveen, the fighting Dutch prosecutor from Christ of all places, Kalamazoo. Other than that, who's complaining? Seriously, though, how are you?
Oh, okay. A little bruised around the edges. Scared. Irritated. Sorry to see my illustrious career fold up quite like this. But that's why I asked you to come up here, to find out how I'm doing. How am I doing, counselor?
You get me up here for legal advice? Precedent to some kind of court-martial proceeding you're expecting?
Partly, but mostly to help me in a broader sense, Charlie. It's an old, trusted, admired friend and wordsmith. To help me put my thoughts together before I have to start telling my story to those people out there in the front lawn. To Corky and the rest of the gang at the Pentagon, to Congressman Rogers and his gang, and to old Bob Vanderveen. How am I doing out there, Charlie?
Not so good, pal. Catching it already from several quarters. Probably going to catch it soon from others. I spent Thursday evening reading that collection of reports and reprints you had delivered. I now know more than I ever wanted to know about tactical nukes, lance missiles, atomic demolition munitions, etc. Give me the old M1 Army, Charlie. Glad I bailed out in time. And these legal pieces, odds and ends from philosophy quarterlies, took me back to my law school days. But I read it all. Most of yesterday I spent at the Pentagon chatting informally with some of our old buddies. Those guys are mostly pretty happy that old Bob wants to flex his prosecutorial muscles and hang you out to dry. Flat refusal to obey a direct presidential order in time of war, etc. That's not good, pal.
But you're here anyway.
Oh, sure. Beats chasing ambulances. Famous client, interesting case. You can probably even afford my fee, if the whole balloon doesn't go up before I get my bill in the mails.
So, what's next?
Well, I wanted to hear from you what your reasons are for refusal. Let's start with that. I want to take some notes, ask some pesky questions, but they won't even compare with the nasty ones you'll get later from others.
Okay. On D plus 13th, Tuesday the 19th, Al Sorley, the commander of the 47th, he's responsible for this piece of my territory, roughly from Munster up through the Netherlands to the Channel. Anyway, Al called, a little frantic. Things were pretty rough up there. The Russians had swept pretty easily across most of that open plains area, grabbing some cities and bypassing others and overrunning and decimating our troops by the tens of thousands.
So what did he want?
Well, he wanted me, or demanded of me would almost be a better way to put it, to ask the president for authority to use tactical nukes to knock out the Bremen airfield. You remember the Russians had seized that on day 2. They were using it very effectively to launch devastating airstrikes and close air support for their ground operations. I checked around, talked to the intelligence and weather guys. I called Al back and I said I just couldn't do it.
And your reasons?
Too many of our troops and West German troops were still being held there as POWs. In the city of Bremen, a big city, Charlie, it's very close to the airfield. And that day it was downwind of it. Al told me he only wanted 6 or 8 5 kiloton bursts to pock up the runways and knock out a tower and shops and catch a couple dozen planes on the ground. But that would have just caused too much damage, too much damn collateral damage. Most of those American and German soldiers would have died. And who knows how many tens of thousands of Bremen civilians would have gotten burned or hit with lethal radiation. As important as it was as a military target, the damage would have been way out of proportion and much less discriminating than I thought or still think we ought to at least try damn hard to be.
Then?
Well, Enel hung up on me, went over my head and called the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, General Butch Thornton. He contacted the President with the request, and the next thing I know, Van der Veen himself is calling me direct in person on an open line, all full of that vim and vigor. That flaming asshole is a He's having this big adventure, the time of his life, playing Churchill in the bunker, saving the Western world with all those colored telephones. And he orders me to launch the strike Al requested. Well, I tried talking him out of it, reasoning and arguing with him, you know, as two grown-up adults might do. Then he reaches down deep and gets out his patent line, you know, just like George C. Scott did it. General, if you haven't got the stomach for modern warfare or the sense of duty to obey your president, I'll have to find me another general who does. He canned me and stuck poor Al into my slot and flew me home Wednesday.
And the Bremen airfield?
It was hit very hard Thursday the 21st.
Our buddies at the Pentagon seem mostly to be convinced by the argument of military necessity in the matter. They think you should have swallowed your qualms and launched the strike.
Well, Charlie, I suppose we've all been wrestling with these things for years. How to arrange the various principles and rules, what takes precedence, how to decide if and when they conflict, where to draw the line. You remember, we used to argue this stuff in Modelsky's class at the Point.
Well, I'll have to admit, I didn't take it all that seriously.
Well, some did and some didn't, but after Vietnam, even some of the cynics did some rethinking. There were all those seminars and anthologies about war and morality. We were all trying to answer the question, what would you do if?
Where did you come down?
Well, I made up my mind a long time ago. I wanted to save some little bit of honor for my dubious profession if I could. Even in the midst of Raymond Aaron's century of total war, even surrounded by the amazing gadgets and incredible firepower that science and technology have blessed us with, blessed even a company commander with, the only way it seemed to this poor, slow mind was to hang on for all I was worth to the old, tried and true principles of proportionality and discrimination. I just couldn't accept the idea that when things get really tough, we can cite military necessity and just forget all the other principles and rules of engagement. All those supposedly inferior rules worked out over the millennia by soldiers and thinkers to regulate combat in some rudimentary ways, at least. No, I made up my mind to try as best I could, even under the chaotic conditions of combat, to remain as thoughtful and careful as it was so much easier to be in the command and general staff college classrooms. I hoped the day would never come when I'd have to refuse a superior order to do something that my reason and education, my training and conscience would tell me was improper, even if effective and superficially necessary. But I hoped, too, that I'd have the courage to do what I did Tuesday.
But couldn't you have used the nukes against the Bremen field, Frank, and then taken refuge in what some of these writers call the principle of double effect, sanctioning some evil or collateral damage in this case as incidental and secondary to the accomplishment of the intended good, as unintended and regrettable, but as a tolerable price to pay for the accomplishment of the primary objective, and thus excusable? I have to ask these questions, Frank. Believe me, others are going to ask them a lot more harshly.
Let me answer you a little bit crudely, Charlie. The principle of double effect doesn't mean that if I see a fly on your forehead, and I'm allowed to swing at it with a 2x4. It doesn't let me destroy the village in order to save it. If you take it seriously, it isn't a loophole. It isn't there to give a moral license to do whatever I want. It calls for moral judgment. And it says that the supposedly incidental damage of an action has to be substantially less of an evil than the supposedly primary damages of a good. In this case, the unintended damage would have included a lot of dead American prisoners of war and even more dead Germans, innocent civilian non-combatants. So yeah, I could have used the double effect as a refuge, but not as an answer.
Okay. Let me try another argument out on you. Some at the shop were puzzled that you refused to use the nukes at Bremen, even though you'd already authorized the use of quite a few nukes in other situations during the first 12 days. How do you answer that, Frank?
Very different situations, Charlie, carefully evaluated separately. In each of those cases, I decided that the nukes could be used consistently with the principles I just mentioned: proportionality, discrimination, military need in its place, double effect, carefully weighed.
So you don't have anything against tactical nukes, per se?
If I had my druthers, Charlie, they'd never been invented. Give me the World War II or Korea arsenal any day. Or maybe even the elegant forms and gadgets of the Middle Ages. But no, I don't have anything against nukes, per se. I think they can be used very occasionally, selectively and carefully, well within my understanding of what you lawyers would call eos in bello restrictions. Mainly, that is, consistent with the principles of proportionality and discrimination.
Okay. Maybe you could run down through those instances of the use of the nukes during the first 12 days for me.
Fine, I've even made some notes. On day one, I authorized the detonation of 12 or 13 atomic demolition munition devices, ADMs we call them, in the passes and narrow defiles just east of Fulda. Now, ADMs are clearly defensive weapons. They have no offensive potentiality whatsoever. We'd very quietly pre-chambered and pre-positioned, well, seeded, if you will, these atomic mines there during the late 70s. We planted those near villages in deeper holes so that when they went off, they'd cause rock slides to block the roads, but the bursts wouldn't break the surface to release any radiation. We planted some near the surface of under bridges in remote areas. And that entire area is pretty remote and rugged. We planted several very small ones, 1/10 of a kiloton, and even less in yield, just under the surface of some roads in densely wooded areas to crater the roads and blow down some surrounding trees to inhibit traffic off the roads and through the forests. It worked, you know. We caught over 400 tanks and associated equipment and military personnel during those first few days.
What was the collateral damage?
Minimal. Almost no civilian casualties. Most of the few people living in that rugged area had left when the crisis really heated up a month ago because they knew Soviet armor would be coming through their neighborhood. And I suppose they knew too that, or at least suspected that, we'd have some pretty dramatic welcoming activities late on. On day three, I agreed to use nukes about 15 miles out to the sea in the channel. The Soviets were moving up on an amphibious landing group to help with their sweep into the lowlands. And a couple of the boats in the groups were doing a lot of electronic intelligence and fire control work to support that sweep. Now, small nukes I used, but better for such sizable moving targets than anything conventional I had. They were delivered by very accurate air-to-surface missiles, precision-guided munitions, what the media calls smart bombs. No civilians in the way, of course, nothing but bona fide combatants. The radiation had dissipated long before it reached the shore.
So it was tactically, ethically kosher.
Well, I thought so. A clearly and purely military target, a collection of them really. And of course, Thornton, the Pentagon, and Vanderveen, they were all pleased to have been able to make a second demonstration to the Soviets, in addition to the ADMs 3 days earlier, that we meant business. We're determined, we're willing to use nuclear weapons to defend Europe. Symbols of intent, you might say, designed to persuade the Soviets to halt their attack, but very carefully and selectively executed signals.
Oh yeah, what we called at the point intra-war deterrence.
Well, I suppose you could put it that way. All right, let's see. On day five, I agreed to Freddy Wolowitz's request that several 8-inch Hollowitzer shells, each carrying mini-nuke warheads, set at less than 1/10 of a kiloton yield, some of these things have selectable yields. You know, you just turn the dial. That several howitzer shells be used to take out a big heavy-duty railroad bridge across the Weser. It was crucial to deny the Soviets that bridge as we fell back. And again, hardly any, if any, civilians got caught. Nobody lives near the east end of the bridge, big swampy marshland. And Freddy's intelligent people had ascertained that the people in the village at the west end had joined the hundreds and hundreds of West German refugees that had been clogging the roads all the way to France. Besides that, we had a convenient opportunity to demonstrate that we were prepared to use nukes on land above ground so as to encourage the Russian commanders to keep their troops dispersed and spread out along the line. They had already started to bunch up for some concentrated assaults along the line, but the bridge strike encouraged them to spread back out again into troop formations, better designed to survive the battlefield nukes, and not so quite good at assaulting our weak points in the lines.
Okay, I understand. I assume the commanders in the other sectors along the front were making similar demonstrations and tactical strikes.
Very selectively, keeping to the game plan, well within the rules. On day 8, I approved a strike with Lance missiles armed with somewhat larger nukes against 17 supply dumps and staging areas to the enemy's rear in East Germany. All 17 had been carefully selected a couple years ago. None was within 10 miles of a town. All were important military targets. 14 of those were put out of business. 3 others were damaged badly. That's how accurate those delivery systems have become. On day 11, we used tactical nuclear weapons delivered by airplane carrier precision-guided munitions.
Smart bombs again.
Right. To hit a train rolling across Poland from Russia, full of chemical agents, nerve gas canisters. The Polish resistance had tipped us. They suggested a dandy remote location. They got a few nearby natives out of the way and helped us time the strike. It's appropriate to use nukes on that target too, rather than conventional weapons, because we wanted that particular cargo incinerated rather than just derailed or blown up. Again, minimal collateral damage.
That's it?
That's all the nukes I authorized. One unauthorized use in my command. A jumpy young Lieutenant Colonel who had just taken over a badly mauled artillery unit. He let loose a few 6-inch shells at some tanks advancing through a pretty heavily populated area. Killed about 90 tanks, which made it possible for him to extricate what was left of his unit. But he killed a hell of a lot of natives, too. Not acceptable. Not intended. We started an investigation right away, and we got the colonel a desk job.
Oh, I thought the nukes were under tighter command control than that.
Well, most are. For all practical purposes, the bombs and missiles remain under Supreme Court, Supreme Command, Europe, and presidential control. But once nuclear warhead artillery shells for the 6 and the 8-inch guns have been distributed, the local commanders do have access to them. In the fog, the chaos, the pressure of battle, it's damned hard to control these released shells in the hands of commanders who've been encircled or about to be overrun. In the old cliche, accidents will happen. But I'm not sure, though, that even that kid, 34 I think he was, I don't think he can be fairly be held responsible for violating the code. It's not exactly the me lie of the 1980s, I shouldn't think. And I'd argue that responsibility certainly wouldn't go any farther up the chain.
Well, it's something to look into. I may want to get more details from you later. I guess I'm willing, for the moment anyway, to buy your arguments that you felt you had sufficient reason to refuse Vanderveen's Bremen order, even though you'd already used lots of nukes in what do seem to me to be ways that paid proper attention to the legal and ethical norms you set for yourself.
But?
Well, I guess I'm a bit surprised at the precision that makes it possible to use even tactical nuclears in the discriminating ways you described. I guess I thought that once battlefield nukes were used, the European landscape, especially West Germany, would be devastated. One of these pieces you gave me, it's the one by Cohen and Van Cleef, they mentioned Operation Carte Blanche, a war game in which, I think they said, 335 nukes were hypothetically exploded and nearly 4 million people got killed, including a lot of civilians. And that was quite a mess, I'd say.
That exercise took place in 1955, Charlie. And the nukes were bigger then because no one was contemplating their use except in the connection with an all-out strategic war between the superpowers. Most were the Hiroshima-type 15-plus kiloton bombs. Now we've got mini nukes down to the 10th of a kiloton in yield, some even smaller, down to a 20th of a kiloton. And our delivery is much more accurate and precise today, mostly because electronics and computers. It gets pretty complicated mathematically, Charlie, but the staff guys can demonstrate that the use of a few nukes is apt to do less collateral damage, knocking out those staging areas and dumps, as I mentioned, than using the many more conventional bombs that we'd have to use to have the same chance of completely knocking out the same target. There are some examples of calculations in that piece by Kane that I gave you, how there were studies done back in the mid-70s by Rand and Stanford Research Institute and Lockheed that showed that both sides in a European war could use hundreds of nukes without doing the damage done in European cities and towns during World War II.
If the Russians cooperated in developing mini nukes, smart bombs, and a selective targeting doctrine as fastidious as yours.
Well, and they seem to have, too. There were signs they would, too, back in the 1970s. I sent over that piece by Galen, didn't I? You know, he reports on the studies that there that suggested that the Soviets had long had a selective targeting plan for the European theater.
But I seem to remember that the Soviets usually talked as if they actually believed in what they used to call, as I recollect, the indivisibility of nuclear war. That nuclear war was nuclear war, and that they had no plans to use battlefield nukes in the discriminating ways you say they've tried to use them.
It's rhetoric designed to enhance the credibility of their deterrent, Charlie. You scare the Germans with big talk about how Europe would be devastated if war started. You make us all believe they were so clumsy and bullheaded, dogmatic and unable to develop accurate systems for delivering small nukes. That we would somehow be more frightened of small nukes. Give up ourselves on the potentialities of tactical nukes if they wouldn't parallel our doctrines and equipment, and then be cowed into concessions in Western Europe. It's almost a classic case of the usual gulf between declaratory policy and action policy, if you like.
Well, that gets us to one other line of questions I'd like to explore, Frank, if you don't mind.
Sure, what other line?
Well, I'd like to explore one final ethical angle. Now, not because it's going to come up in court, if we ever go to court, because it's not. More to prod you to get your thoughts together for the broad purposes you mentioned at the outset.
Fine with me, shoot.
Okay, I told you that you were catching it already from several quarters. Most of what you said might, just might, satisfy some of our fraternity brothers. But your flank, or rear, if you'll pardon me, is exposed. Did you see the Times editorial this morning?
No.
I'll read you some of it. It's laudable that General Dunbar, citing grounds of conscience and his understanding of the ethical norms supposed to govern an officer in combat, refused President Vanderveen's immoderate, some would say outrageous, order to destroy Bremen in order to destroy the Bremen airfield, etc., etc. But here's our main point. General Dunbar, together with the other highest-ranking officers and their civilian superiors, must take his share of the blame for the fact that it was the United States and not the Soviet Union that first used nuclear weapons in this war, crossing the nuclear threshold for the first time since 1945, violating the well-established firebreak, and setting us all off on a course that might well result in escalation to the level of strategic exchange and wholesale global catastrophe. If we go that far, and many analysts suggest it is now virtually inevitable that we will, General Dunbar's admirable battlefield restraint and moral fussiness will not rescue him from damnation by whatever survivors are around to write the postmortems. End quote, pal. Heavy stuff. Is there a great moral issue here, Frank? What might be called the first use issue?
We thought the Soviets had already used them first. Their doctrine, their field exercises, all indicated that they would use battlefield nukes from the moment they jumped off. Intelligence was ambiguous. Our so-called theater was a madhouse, Charlie. The intensity of the battle, the noise, the confusion, the pace of everything was just simply incredible. People, all of us are just way out of their league with this hardware. Talk about the fog of war has got the wrong meteorological metaphor, believe me. It's more like a monsoon or a cyclone of war. A 1,000-mile-long front, a contact line 100 miles deep, 10,000 tanks, 70% casualties in a 15,000-man division in 4 days. 4 days, Charlie, not 4 months. Lots of young captains forced into the command of battalions and even regiments, using fuel and ammunition at such a rate that some of the other sector and division commanders were almost forced to use nukes because they'd run so low on conventional stuff. Well, anyway, intelligence was ambiguous. Couldn't get any straight answers from anyone. Navy intelligence said they didn't think the Russians had used them, but they couldn't be sure. Air Force satellite intelligence swore they detected bursts against not only our reconnaissance and communication satellites in orbit on day one, but also some of our shipping in the North Atlantic. German intelligence swore that the Soviets had not used nukes yet, but we wondered if they could be trusted since they had good reasons for hoping that we would hold off on using our nukes on their pretty landscape.
I always thought that the monitoring gadgetry was going to be able to detect the radioactivity.
Imperfectly, pal, imperfectly. These people are wizards at demonstrating Murphy's Law, and the Peter Principle is working overtime, too. Thornton asked the president point blank when he called on day one to get presidential release of the nukes. If Van der Veen himself knew whether Soviets had used nukes yet at that point, and Van der Veen just dithered and waffled as usual.
But now we know that the Russians had not yet used them, that we used them first.
So what? No, I'm serious. I've given a lot of thought, Charlie. I'd rather we'd not have used them first. But really, what difference does it make? Ethically, who used the damn things first? For starters, they attacked us, so they lose a couple moral points right there, okay? Secondly, if my own use of small nukes is consistent with the tried, true, tested, refined, honorable principles of proportionality and discrimination, if they're so small and used so carefully as to do zero or minimal collateral damage to civilians and property and the landscape, then that so-called threshold or firebreak that everyone's so worried about doesn't even mean a thing.
Are you so sure?
The nukes I used were no different in their moral significance from the so-called conventional weapons I was using, some of which are in some ways more damaging and destructive. In either case, Charlie, you've got chemical activity going on that results in explosive power. What difference does it make, morally here again, what difference does it make if the chemicals are combining rapidly in combustion or fragmenting even more rapidly in fission?
Well, geez, some would say, some in fact are already saying that you and the Prez, we all, I guess, let me see, how does the Post editorial put it? They're all ganging up on you, the Eastern Establishment Press. Maybe Spiro Agnew was right. Quote, move the conflict into another arena, escalating what might well have remained a conventional war into a nuclear war that will now almost certainly escalate to engulf us all. End quote.
That's bull. My use, our use of small nukes didn't escalate anything. Okay, one, the level of destructiveness is not escalated very damn much when two small tactical nukes are used to take out a bridge or blow up a mountain pass instead of the 15 or 20 old-fashioned blockbusters that might have been used instead. Two, the geographical scope of the war isn't escalated by tactical nukes. For the most part, the conflict has been confined to the European space. And since Moscow achieved a second strike capability in the 60s, everyone has accepted, deep down anyway, the separating of European events from the Moscow-Washington mutual threat game. So the conflict will very probably remain confined to Europe, even if one or the other side starts to lose badly.
I hope you're right. You've got more faith than I have in cool heads prevailing, my friend.
Anyway, to the limited extent that it spilled beyond the European space, it spilled over lots more because of airplanes, missiles, ocean-going ships, satellites, and electronics than because of the nuclear nature of some of the weaponry. And three, the political stakes, it seems to me, are clearly limited and limiting. I'd argue that these variables, scale, geography, and politics, they define the important firebreaks, not technology in the abstract. Not technology at all, except as insofar as technology, along with important other factors, determines scale. In fact, I could argue, I think, that I set a good model, that it was positively good for me to be the first one to use nukes because I used them properly. Better for me to have set some precedence for others to notice than to have some ham-handed Igor or latter-day LeMay be the first user.
In summary, then, you don't agree that using battlefield nukes will automatically result in escalation to the strategic level?
Not at all. That's the old dogma, the indivisibility of nuclear war again, that we fought the Russians for holding. Though if they ever held it for a while to bolster their deterrence bluffs, and threats in the 60s when they were a paranoid second best, they almost certainly dropped it quietly years ago in their serious planning sessions. Interestingly enough, German General Graf von Kielmansegg, you've got his article there, he says this is an American dogma too, and calls for what he calls the demythologizing of nuclear weapons and the development of different policies and procedures for different kinds of nukes, instead of trying to treat them all the same, whether they're mini nukes of below a tenth of a kiloton or megaton strategic weapons.
Well, Frank, wouldn't it really be very difficult to wage a limited nuclear war for very long without psychological and political pressures to escalate becoming just unbearable?
The so-called limited strategic nuclear war, involving counterforce strikes against Soviet and American military targets, and then maybe up on the ladder to the controlled exchange of cities, city for city, tit for tat, Minsk for Detroit, that would probably be uncontrollable because of the inevitable heavy collateral damage and the fallout, the psychological, the political pressures to escalate. But I don't really believe that war in Europe or in the Middle East or wherever calls into play the same factors and pressures, at least not on the decision makers in Moscow and Washington. If this war escalates so that Americans and Russians start using strategic nuclear weapons against each other's homelands, with less and less concern for adherence to the dual principles of
proportionality and discrimination, I know.
It won't be because we crossed some imaginary nuclear threshold 2 weeks ago, very reluctantly and defensively and carefully, and in my view, properly. It'll be because the leaders on both sides consciously expanded the stakes, they took the next steps, they decided to enlarge the geographical arena of the conflict, and they cranked up the big guns.
No responsibility to the guy who cast the first blow. The first nuclear blow, that is.
Not in my judgment. Look, Charlie, I, the president, Thornton, the other generals, we're not like some guy on the top of the hill who pushes the first boulder and has to take responsibility for the avalanche that follows. Nobody who starts an avalanche can turn it off once it's started. After all, it's just physics, gravity, momentum, motion, out of control of human agency. But Charlie, diplomacy, still going on, I noticed, even in the midst of all this fracas. Diplomacy and warfare are not like an avalanche. You hear loose talk that war has its own escalatory dynamic. Well, that's what it is, loose talk. And it obscures the fact that each notch up the ladder requires human action based on perceptions, cognitions, emotions, choices, practical military considerations, and damn it, moral values.
All right, easy.
Sorry, but Charlie, if our Prez and his new Northern Sector General, or the gangsters in the Kremlin, if they crank this one up to the level of strategic exchanges of megaton yield weaponry, they can't get off the moral hook by pointing the accusing finger at me for crossing their damn nuclear threshold. I'm happy to bear the responsibility for my own actions. I'm probably not responsible for actions taken by others that were almost inevitable or almost unavoidable because of the context that my early actions only helped to shape. And I'm sure as hell not responsible for actions taken later by others that were clearly avoidable choices or at least not at all inevitable. There's no reason obvious to me why the people in charge can't remain in control and keep to the limits. Keep to those limits they settled upon. Warfare, even warfare involving nuclear weapons, though it's untidy and unpredictable and filled with awful pressures, God knows, it's not usually completely uncontrolled or in some fundamental way uncontrollable. Tactical nuclear warfare doesn't inexorably and automatically have to escalate to all-out strategic nuclear war. If we keep saying that it does, we'll make it happen.
Well, Frank, I gotta say, you make some good points. A little surprising, even distressing, but persuasive.
Did you get your way with the dean, as usual?
Partly. Small thing, and he's distracted. Not much inclined to refuse just now. How about you two? Have you old soldiers been getting your ducks in a row?
Pretty well. Frank's been...
Don't tell me, Charlie. Let me guess. By now, Frank has almost convinced you that he was right to refuse Van de Veen's order, but also that using nukes can be squared with just war doctrine. Proportionality, discrimination, all that, right?
Well.
Oh, don't look so perplexed, Charlie. Lawyers shouldn't. Not good for their image. Frank and I have been having the same discussion that you two have just had for, must be 30 years. War and ethics. mostly calmly, like two civilized debaters. Did you know that we first met in debate at Oxford during Frank's year on the Rhodes Scholarship?
But you weren't convinced.
I married a Yank soldier, and I love him still, and I respect him too. Partly because of his attachment to that old Catholic code of his. It's important. It's something, at least.
But...
Oh, I don't want to do this. Please.
No, go ahead. Charlie ought to hear it. Your reservations. Might even do your old Yank warrior some good to have his mouthpiece properly briefed.
Well, I don't know if I'm up to it. The time's just so wrong.
It's not going to get any better, Margaret.
All right, then. Your just war code is better than nothing. Some rules, sometimes respected by some soldiers. The most conscientious ones, like you, Frank.
Well, thanks for that, anyway.
But it's... there are too many things wrong with it. It's too ambiguous, for starters. Too susceptible to diverse idiosyncratic interpretation for it to serve as a dependable operating code of conduct. And it's too loose. The tests are too permissive. And the code makes it too easy for you to find an excuse, a license to do almost whatever you really want to do.
To use tactical nukes, for example?
Yes.
Oh, I don't know. It didn't seem that easy for Frank to satisfy himself, and I think I pressed him pretty hard.
Please, Charlie, I really don't want to argue all this. Just let me sort of recite it, okay?
Okay, I'll just take notes.
Now, your code also helps to perpetuate the militarization of public policy. Just war theory, at least the part of it Frank uses, simply isn't political enough.
But Frank's a soldier, not a politician. He's never even been a very good Pentagon politician.
Wonderful, Charlie. That's exactly what Frank always says. And I always remind him of what Clausewitz said, that war is the ultimate extension of politics.
I still don't get your point.
All right. First, the parts of just war theory that Frank has been expounding to you are really just a battlefield code. If I may be strident for a moment, they provide us with an etiquette of mass slaughter. As I've said, I'm glad it exists, even though sometimes I think too many people take false comfort in the knowledge that at least some of the military do have a code of ethics, so our side won't do the dastardly things the other side will do.
Concerned with the bigger picture.
Yes. The other part of the code. The part that tells us when we can go to war with a good conscience. When, if ever, war is justified. And I've come to believe that this part of just war theory helps make our politics topsy-turvy. It encourages us to put primary things secondary things first.
All right. What's primary, Margaret? What's secondary?
What are the basic, the ultimate goals of politics? I'd say they're life, liberty, justice, happiness, dignity, well-being, human rights, human interests. Truly fundamental roles that modern warfare, even following your battlefield code, sacrifices or at least endangers at the outset, and all for the sake of secondary penultimate values.
Such as?
Sovereignty, territorial boundaries, the existing political and economic order, defense of the state, national credibility, national honor.
Now look, some of those values you call primary can't survive except by protecting the values you make secondary. It's just elementary that without some kind of order, you can't have liberty, maybe not even life. You can't really have justice without some kind of state. Sorry for butting in.
Yeah, but if you hadn't, I would have. And then I'd follow up with some examples. What about Hitler? What about our Civil War? I know it was a mixed bag, but it had something to do with freeing the slaves. For that matter, what about this war? If the Soviets take over Europe, a whole lot of very basic values are going to go right down the drain.
Those are very good questions. As Frank knows, I once thought they were unanswerable, but not anymore.
Anyhow, I just don't see how just war theory has anything to do with your topsy-turviness.
Okay, let me ask you a rhetorical question. What threatens our national interest more? Capture of Cuba or the erosion of our topsoil in Iowa, say? I think you know my answer. Once that top coil is done, and it is going at an astonishing rate, it's gone. There's no way to replenish it. Now that's a serious problem, a whole lot more serious than anything Fidel Castro could conceivably do to this country. But which problem gets more attention from politicians, the media, the people? Obviously, it's Cuba, that communist spearhead 90 miles off our shore. Now, why is this?
No, I want to hear your answer, Margaret.
Just what the forum called for. Charlie, I think it's because not only our policies, but our minds have been militarized. Maybe even our souls. Just by surviving in our space, as we think of it, Castro creeps down noses so he gets more attention than he deserves. Besides, Cuba can be defined as a military problem. It can be war games. By making us think of Cuba as a dangerous enemy, politicians can press the patriotism button and get us to rally behind us. Erosion, in contrast, isn't a military problem, and it isn't an external problem. It can only be solved by changing ourselves, our whole way of doing agriculture. Now that would be hard. It would be divisive. It would take real political and technical genius to solve the problem. So we turn away from it. We refuse to define it as a serious challenge to the national interest.
I'm not sure I see how just war theory has much of anything to do with all this.
Well, because it has such a powerful hold on our thinking, our definitions, our policies. And it's so statist, so nationalistic, and so preoccupied with one's military. It's less interested in human rights and human interests than it pretends to be, than it should be. Military defense of the nation against military attack is always and automatically primary. Other values, other challenges, other tasks are subordinated or neglected. Your code would have us go to war to prevent Russian soldiers from moving our border back a foot. But the code doesn't see erosion as a national interest problem because erosion doesn't involve military assault by foreign forces invading across a territorial border. And erosion is just one example. Think of energy conservation, the black underclass, the condition of our schools. Armed to the teeth, we look the other way.
Well, I think you exaggerate, Margaret, but I guess I follow you at least.
Your just war code also strikes me as badly dated, passed by maybe. Maybe, just maybe, despite its militaristic and nationalistic flavor, it wasn't so seriously flawed 200 years ago, even 50 years ago. Even back then, though, the rule that violence must discriminate between combatants and non-combatants was probably unfair to combatants, making them fair game. Since most of them were unwilling draftees who were innocent civilians and thus immune, projected the day before their luck ran out and they were drafted, usually because they'd been too careless in their choice of parents and had been born into the wrong surface trap. Oh, that was nice. Boys.
But these days?
Today, at least since World War II, I'd say the codes are mechanistic. With modern weaponry and large armies, war is so vast, so complex, so messy. The cyclone metaphor you always use, Frank. Well, it's just unrealistic to expect the warriors can obey the restraints in the midst of cyclone. And aren't impossible to obey commands generally recognized as devoid of moral force?
Well, I suppose, strictly speaking, technically, yes.
Atrocities are inevitable. Let me remind you, Charlie, of what actually happened to Berman this week. We all saw the aerial photographs on television. If you know in advance that atrocities are going to occur, don't you have an obligation to refrain from participating? If it's impossible for the conduct of war to be ethical, then resort to war can't ever be ethical either, can it? So isn't the code the entirety of just war doctrine a dead letter, more or less?
You would replace it with what?
No, I'm not sure. This is where we always get stuck, isn't it? This is where I usually insist that war is a cultural artifact, something that didn't have to be, that need not have dominated human history the way it has. Then I insist that in any case, Technology has rendered it too dangerous an activity today, an obsolete game. It follows that if war is obsolete, then France is improperly helping to prop it up, delaying the development of progressive alternatives, unethically squandering his considerable gifts by withholding them from the pitiful little efforts you see here and there to create a replacement for war as a final arbiter. That's better. At this point in the argument, France either gets defensive or sullen, maybe because by this time I'm getting a bit stale. Our debate tends to degenerate.
That's a bit lofty, Margaret. Let me bring you down to earth. Suppose the nation is attacked. What would you have the leaders do?
Keep the ultimate human goals in mind. Resist non-violently, perhaps. Maybe even surrender, followed by pleading and coping with the occupation as it comes, patiently pressing for change.
Surrender?
Isn't that what the Danes did when the Nazis arrived? It was so obviously more sensible, more protective of real human values than to order the citizenry to fight under the code and die for the last man, woman, and child, wasn't it?
But Margaret, Denmark had no choice.
You mean because it was too little to fight? Yes, and I would argue that today, confronted with the dimensions of the threat posed by nuclear weapons and the rest of its gadgetry, all countries, even the most powerful, are little countries. If we truly care about ethics, about all those ultimate values, if we care about our own lives, children, the planet, we have to find, to create, really, some kind of policy analogous to what Denmark did.
So you finally moved all the way to pacifism, Margaret.
Maybe so. I guess so. I'm less impressed with Christian just war theory and more impressed than I was before with the other Christian argument, Christian pacifism, Sermon on the Mount, turn the other cheek and all. But I could put it in the terms of an ethical humanist view that I'm also finding more and more convenient. That warfare per se is an improper activity, like slavery or the ritual sacrifice of maidens, say, never justified. And that you, Frank, try to behave, soldiers try to behave like they're still acting morally. You've been an honorable soldier, the most honorable, I really think, in all the world, but this is hard for me to say. You can't believe any longer that soldiering itself can be honorable.
Oh, Margaret, that's going a little bit far, isn't it?
Well, is it, Charlie? I don't think so anymore. I think the pacifist is right in thinking that love, trust, hope, and confidence, what Christians call faith, hold more promise than violence and war do. Love, hope, the rest, they are noble. They respect the sanctity of life. Maybe they simply must be the stance of those who want consistency, self-respect, serenity, for the Christian, salvation, and peace.
That's a lot to take in. A little romantic. A little unrealistic, though, no?
Oh, I know it can sound goofy, Charlie, or womanish, but do you think Martin Luther King was goofy? Or Gandhi? Or that French pastor in World War II who made his whole village into a refuge for Jews? I know that neither King nor Gandhi did all they hoped to do. I know they were both shot to death, but they weren't defeated. And it was the British Empire that lost. In the South, with the blacks, it was Bull Connor and all his buddies who lost. And they were not defeated by violence, unless it was their own. To me, now it seems those people, Gandhi, King, their followers, were less visionary and romantic than the so-called realists, those think-tank gurus who thought deterrence would work forever, and that sensible Russians and sensible Americans would always remain in control of nuclear weapons that they'd never use, and that global business would go on as usual, indefinitely. As of today, Charlie, how would you measure the goofiness index of that kind of thing?
I don't know.
Needless to say, Charlie, I've never been able to buy into that position. Not today's global jungle. much as I'd like to see warfare go the way of slavery in the history of justice, the world is just not there yet. Those who followed your advice, Margaret, and laid down their arms would be quickly swallowed up.